This is an ABC podcast.
This is a storm. It's the end of a big cyclone. And as you can hear, it's an enormously powerful event. Among natural disasters, heat waves are the most deadly and fires scare us the most. But floods brought by storms like this are the most expensive. And storms like this are extremely expensive all by themselves. They smash public infrastructure and private property. And once they're over, the reckoning begins. And that reckoning can affect a whole country for decades. Hello, Richard Adey with you. This is The Money. We'll come back to storms later in the show. We begin with wages. As you know, the Albanese government's trying to pilot its new industrial relations bill through the Senate. One of the things the new law is supposed to do is help to push up wages. Now, there's been a lot said about this piece of legislation over the last week or so, but will it do that? Angela Jackson is lead economist at Impact Economics. Angela, how important is this bill for doing that, for pushing wages higher?
Look, it's one of those things, Richard, where we're going to have to wait and see. So with all these reforms, and I think the government itself is not sort of predicting what impact the reforms will have on lifting wages across the economy, we will have to wait and see what the data shows in the years ahead. It will be obviously a little bit tricky because it's coming in at a time when there are a lot of other pressures through the economy that are pushing wages up. Record low unemployment, a huge number of job vacancies, 470,000 still across the economy, all factors that are pushing up wages. But there are some structural sort of elements to the bill which will help, I think, underpin stronger wages growth. And it's not just about the multi-employer based bargaining, which is getting a lot of attention because it's a contentious area, but there are other measures in there around pay equity, around transparency, around wages, which should also help lift wage rates across the economy.
But I do want to ask you about that, the one that is the most contentious, because what the bill would do, if it becomes an act, would make it easier for workers of different concerns to strike. How important is that ability to at least have the ability to threaten to strike for obtaining genuine wage rises?
Is the threat of strike action important? Look, theoretically, yes, obviously. And I think it strengthens the arm, I guess, of workers in those negotiations. But it's not the only thing, I think, that is at play here. It's really about those individual level agreements or those agreements between workers and employers around productivity improvements that can be traded off directly for those wage increases that collective agreements allow for, and that if you don't have those in place, then you can lose out and workers can lose out on gaining the benefits from some of those productivity improvements.
The RBA Governor, Philip, though, the other day more or less said, look, you need to get used to lower wages. Now, That hasn't gone down well, but is he right?
So I think it's interesting. So obviously, well, Australians are experiencing lower wages at the moment. And he drew the parallel to the 1970s where wages did effectively keep up with inflation, and that just caused this ongoing spiral of higher inflation, higher wages, which did undermine economic growth and living standards more broadly. And so what he's really saying, I think, to Australian workers is, look, if you can just hold on and hold out for a bit longer, then we can get inflation back to the 2-3% range. We can provide you certainty over that and we'll all benefit from that. That's difficult. I mean, it's a difficult thing to tell workers, particularly those on low incomes, where they've already faced huge real wage declines and they've got the prospect of future real wage declines, and that is eating into their living standards and their ability to pay for basic things. And we've seen some data on that last week in terms of healthcare costs and the number of people who aren't seeing a GP because of the cost went up 50% last year. Now, those sort of impacts on low-income households, it's very difficult, I think, for us to sort of stand here and go, well, sorry, you've got to cop it. And probably for, you know, 2 or 3 more years, you're going to have to cop it so we can get inflation under control. Yeah. But in terms of, is he right? Well, he is. But I think in terms of what the policy answer to that might be, I think we need to start having that discussion more broadly.
There has been a bit of a, well, hang on, mate, you're on $1 million a year, so don't come at me with that.
And I think, you know, the question around the wages and the advice around wages, you know, it's him trying to do his best to manage expectations, I think, and to lower, I guess, their need. Because if wages do take off, and they take off seriously, that will mean higher interest rates, and that will really, really hurt the economy and hurt the Australian population. So I think, you know, he is just, I think, trying to manage those expectations. Mm. And yes, I think the flip side of that really for government is to be thinking a little bit more around how did we actually get inflation down in the 80s? How did we lower those wage increases? And we did that through the social wage really in this country, and we did it through things like Medicare. And there were deals done where workers took lower pay increases as a trade-off for that increase in social wage. And so I think we do need to start having a conversation, particularly, you know, for those Australians who are going to struggle to meet some of their basic service needs, about what those trade-offs might look like in the years ahead to underpin this sort of, I guess, this deal between workers and employers in the broader economy, that they're going to take these lower wage increases.
But the Treasurer is extremely mindful of the debt situation, and he's trying to manage that down. And any increase on the fiscal side with social wages, like you were just talking about, that's going to cost more money.
And it's all trade-offs. So I think really, you know, there are some, I think, you know, the line in the budget around this, you know, they held it pretty tight in terms of that cost of living relief and not even providing it in a targeted sense and in a targeted way. But I think there are ways of providing that relief in a way that doesn't add unduly to demand. So we're not talking here about one-off payments that are incredibly, you know, add to aggregate demand very quickly and immediately. But whether or not to alleviate some of these cost of living pressures, some greater investments, particularly around that social wage question, need to be considered, because this problem isn't going away. I think one of the things is we've seen this, you know, massive over 4% decline in real wages in the last 12 months, but we're going to have, you know, a similar level probably again, and then, you know, real wages are not going to go up for a couple of years if, you know, if those forecasts, you know, come to fruition, or, you know, the reality of these things, of course, often, Richard, is that they don't. And so I think we do need to have that question, particularly for low-income earners. What are they going to get if they're not going to get these wage rises? If we're going to say, well, that would be really, really bad for the economy, they can't keep taking these hits.
So thinking caps on for the government, Angela?
I think it is, in terms of what sort of targeted relief that they can provide, and smart relief. So I think what we saw in the May budget, or not the May, the March budget, sorry, it's normally a May budget, but this year the March budget, it wasn't very smart cost of living relief. It really did add to aggregate demand and made inflation worse. But I think we can do it in a way that doesn't necessarily do that. The childcare, you know, I think legislation, which if it didn't go through last week, maybe is going through this week, certainly helps as well. Mm. You know, that is part of the social wage, increasing childcare subsidies. So there are other things the government can look at doing.
That is where we'll leave it. Thank you very much for joining us on The Money.
Oh, thank you very much.
Angela Jackson from Impact Economics. China needs to adjust its COVID policy and support its property sector. That's not coming from me. That's the latest from the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF. The organisation has something to say about all sorts of countries and what they're doing right or wrong with their economies very, very frequently. The IMF's job is to provide emergency loans to countries that need them. But how good is it at doing that job? Well, according to Jamie Martin, it's certainly active. The Harvard researcher says the IMF's made a record amount in emergency loans.
The IMF has actually been extremely busy over the last year making an extraordinarily large amount of emergency loans to many member states that are experiencing financial distress. And the IMF is really the only global institution that is able to step in and offer some kind of financial assistance to nearly any state on earth.
Yeah. You have written that the IMF's reputation as a domineering taskmaster has left it in this, well, weird position. It's much needed, little loved, enormously powerful, often ineffectual in getting states to agree to its terms. And we've seen that, haven't we, recently, though, that it still has clout.
Yeah, absolutely. The International Monetary Fund certainly does still have clout. The problem is that during past episodes, the IMF developed something of a bad reputation for itself as insisting on painful domestic reforms and austerity policies as the price of its help. So I think one question now going forward is to what extent will the IMF continue to insist on these old kinds of conditionalities as potentially more and more states again turn to it for help?
We should probably go back to the beginning of what the IMF was set up to do, because it came out of Bretton Woods, didn't it?
Yes. Essentially, the aim of the Bretton Woods conference was to rewrite the rules of the international monetary system so that, you know, the world economy can essentially be reconstructed. And as a result of Bretton Woods, you see the creation of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And in this new system, the aim of the IMF was essentially to help member states experiencing short-term financial distress by making financial resources available to them. And one kind of crucial aspect of the IMF's mission was to provide this help to member states to allow them to rejoin the world economy, while at the same time giving them more freedom on the national level to experiment with welfarism, with expansive fiscal and monetary policies. So the IMF at first, it really wasn't supposed to be this kind of browbeating institution.
Yeah. Well, when did it change, or how did it change then? Because it did continue to offer financial assistance, but increasingly with strings attached.
Yeah, you see this actually developing relatively early in the IMF's existence. Over the 1950s, it begins to offer financial assistance to some of its member states, particularly member states in Latin America, that come with demands for significant changes to fiscal and monetary policies, for, you know, essentially fiscal austerity, for tighter monetary policies in states undergoing inflation. This is not a kind of conditionality that is applied across the board. It's not applied to most European member states, but it does begin to develop at this point.
So we get to the 1990s. Of course, the Soviet Union collapses in the early 90s. The IMF has this massive, most ambitious series of tasks ever to kind of oversee that transition to capitalism. And then we get the Asian economic crisis, and that is where it kind of started to really overreach.
The way in which the IMF responds to the so-called Asian financial crisis of 1997-1998 gives a kind of a sense to many states that they might actually be better off guaranteeing their own financial insurance rather than having to depend on this international institution.
Well, there's a photo from your article that goes back to 1998, and it kind of encapsulates the moment, because it's got the then Indonesian President Suharto signing an agreement and the then IMF Director General standing, not quite over him, but behind him, arms folded, watching, looking rather stern. And we know that Suharto doesn't really survive the changes that he had to make to his country to get that help. And that Asian financial crisis really does kind of change the relationship between member states and the institution.
So what you see happen in Indonesia is essentially, you know, when the kind of financial crisis arrives, it feeds into the very kind of fraught domestic political and economic situation. The value of the Indonesian currency plummets, and Suharto really finds himself agreeing to the terms of an IMF bailout in early 1998 that involve extensive domestic reforms, not only to domestic financial systems, but also to sources of political patronage that the Suharto regime had relied on. And what you see happen, in part as a result of the removal of subsidies for fuel and food in the country, that this feeds into political turmoil. The government's overthrown in the spring of 1998, and, you know, it was something of a lesson, I think.
Other countries take that lesson. They look at that political turmoil. They look at the regime change that happened in Indonesia in particular, and they basically decide that they're not going to ask the IMF for help?
Yeah. So first of all, I think it's important to emphasize that the IMF, you know, it didn't overthrow the regime, right? However, it was clear at the time, and certainly has become more clear since then, that members of the U.S. Treasury, they did come to see the overthrow of Suharto as essentially necessary for the country's financial stabilization. So I think what you see other countries kind of begin to come to terms with is the idea that crises of financial globalization like this can be enormously politically destabilizing, and that if the only solution at a moment of emergency is to turn to an institution that is so dominated by the United States government and that can insist on these politically very painful and risky reforms, that they'd probably be wise to develop alternative means of dealing with financial emergency. And so what you see happen is this strategy of many states of accumulating vast stockpiles of foreign currency reserves, which at a moment of crisis can be used to pay off foreign debts or import necessities or to defend the value of a currency without needing to turn to international financial institutions for a bailout loan.
Some of these countries have been turning to China for economic assistance.
Yeah, so China has become the world's largest bilateral official creditor over the last several years. And increasingly, it has also emerged into this new position of making emergency financial bailout loans as well, essentially setting itself up even more directly as a competitor to the International Monetary Fund. So I think that there is a lot of discussion right now over what kind of lender is China at the end of the day, as it faces now the situation in which many states are facing the possibility of defaulting on their loans to China. Is China going to be kind of meaningfully different as a creditor, or is it not?
So there must be pressure then, Jamie, to change the IMF. I mean, it's sort of not working the way it was originally anticipated to work. And as you've just been outlining, many countries that perhaps would benefit from an IMF working in that original way have been forced to go elsewhere.
There have been calls for reform that have come from many different actors, particularly in the global south. And I think there's been more of an audience for consideration of some of these reforms recently within the institution than perhaps at past moments. Since the global financial crisis, the institution itself has come to insist more and more that it has changed its practices, that austerity can be, you know, very detrimental to growth, that inequality is a newly important concern, and so on and so forth. I think in practice, though, researchers have found that the IMF does tend to continue to insist on fiscal consolidation and other things like this as the price of its assistance, even while it's kind of changed its tone rhetorically.
Yeah,
however, it does also seem as though the rise of China as a competitor is forcing the IMF to moderate the terms that it insists on for states that, you know, are also turning to China for assistance.
Well, actually, this is something you don't address in the article, Jamie, but I did wonder what would be the changes needed to ensure that the IMF is, if we could say, properly fit for purpose?
Well, I mean, one thing that we have seen the institution do recently is for the IMF to make emergency liquidity available to states without strings attached, particularly in the form of special drawing rights, which is essentially an artificial reserve asset that can provide some financial assistance to states, but without the same kind of conditionalities as a traditional IMF loan. And we saw $650 billion of SDRs created and allocated during the COVID pandemic. But since then, this has not been repeated. Just quickly on the point of so-called SDRs, when it was allocated, it went to both wealthy and lower and middle income countries alike. So countries that didn't need this help got it, and countries that really, really needed this help didn't get enough of it. So now there's also kind of corresponding mobilization around this question of how to redistribute this asset. And these kind of discussions are ongoing right now.
But do you think that we will see meaningful change?
I think that particularly as the severity of the global climate crisis becomes more and more clear, that there will have to be changes in the way in which international financial institutions kind of mobilize financial assistance for states around the world. I think that there's kind of little illusion at the IMF itself that this is going to be one of the principal tasks it will face in the coming years. I do think the question, though, is, will it do business differently? Will it treat states in a way that they do not interpret as heavy-handed and bullying? And here, I think that it's very uncertain. The IMF, like many institutions, is very, very slow to change. This means that reform can be quite difficult. Major reform can be very difficult to implement.
Jamie Martin's Assistant Professor of History and Social Studies at Harvard University. One of the issues that's come up again and again this year is climate change. As too many Australians are personally very aware, a warming planet means bigger storms and more flooding. But that's not the end of it, according to Mehmet Ulubasoglu. The Deakin economist says it's making some countries less democratic.
Climate change seems to lead to more frequent and more severe meteorological extremities, floods, bushfires, and storms being among them. And we analyze the storms, and in the wake of storm events, especially island countries become more autocratic.
How does that work? Because it doesn't sound like it's an obvious sort of thing.
Sure. I mean, serious storm events affect the infrastructure, properties, and human and non-human lives, but they also affect the political system, especially after storms. The government is expected to step in and provide relief and recovery assistance to citizens. And in countries where the social contracts are not strong enough, the constitutions are not strong enough, this leads to a window of opportunity for the government. In exchange for relief and recovery assistance, the governments may buy a license to oppress citizens. And especially the citizens need the relief and recovery assistance after the storms. And there becomes a mutually agreed equilibrium, political equilibrium, where the government oppresses and the citizens yield to it. So essentially, this is an effect of the storms on the political system, whereby the governments restrict political rights, civil liberties, they introduce curfews, they deploy the military, and the normal checks and balances are suspended.
Yeah, I could, as you say that, I can imagine it happening. I can imagine the government saying, well, this is an emergency. So, we're going to have a curfew for a bit. We're going to bring the army in because they'll help deploy all the help and aid. And it's just an event that's probably happened on many occasions.
That is correct. I mean, army is needed because of its training in the emergency situations, and many developed countries use armies in these situations. The issue is how to get them back to their barracks. In countries where the political system is not solid enough, the governments may elevate this disaster militarism to the next level, and they may use the military for restricting the political rights and civil liberties further.
You're an economist, Mehmet. So this is the government is deploying and using funding, and that kind of opens the door for this social license, which can then be abused. Does that mean that international aid, say there is a terrible storm in a place and there's widespread appeal and other countries, maybe like Australia, send money, that money can end up doing the wrong things?
That is true. To provide the relief and recovery assistance, the government may use two sources, the domestic budget and international aid. And typically, storms are big events. The domestic budgets may not accommodate all the expenditures immediately. So international aid comes into play here, and it becomes sort of the financing mechanism of the operation. The island governments use the international aid to buy the social license for operation.
Have you done the research that kind of explores this?
Yes, we have analyzed 70 years of data from 1950 to 2020 for the seven island countries, some of which are storm-prone and some of which are storm-free. So we were able to compare storm-prone countries and storm-free countries in times where there was storm in a given year and there was not. So in a way, we made such comparisons using the polity score, the democracy score, which measures the democracy level of the country from a full autocracy to mature democracy. And we found that the storms in island countries reduced the democracy score significantly after the event.
So how much effect did you find there?
The immediate effect is a 4% decline in the polity score after the storm, but then the effect continues over the next 6 to 7 years. So considering all the yearly effects, we find that there is a 25% decline in the Pulitzer score in the next 6 to 7 years after the storm.
That's significant, actually, yes. Mm. So, of course, it's not just islands that get hit by storms. We get hit by plenty of them here in Australia. What about countries that are part of larger landmasses?
We did not find the same effect in landlocked or coastal countries that face storms. And we found the effect in island countries. And that's particularly because storms enter from one corner of the country and exit from the other corner. So island countries are fully exposed. So the national outcome, like democracy score, that effect is revealed more strongly in islands.
So what are the examples? You said you looked at seven countries, some of which are storm prone and some of which are not. Which countries are we talking about?
Yes, 47 countries, and some of them are in the Caribbean, some of them are in the East Indian Ocean. In the Caribbean, we have Haiti, Dominican Republic, Cuba. Indian Ocean, we have Madagascar, Sri Lanka, and also in the Asia Pacific, the Philippines, Fiji, Solomon Islands, Vanuatu. And the effect is strongest in these countries.
So which countries specifically can you say, well, look, here was a storm and here was the loss of democracy, gaining of power for an autocrat?
Yeah, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Philippines come into play here. Looking at their histories, especially, and the contemporary political systems, they seem to be affected hugely by storms. For instance, in Dominican Republic in 1930s, there was Rafael Trujillo. 2.5 weeks after the ascension to the power, the Dominican Republic faced this major storm, and Trujillo was quick enough to use this opportunity to oppress the nation for the next 30 years.
And have there been any events where democracy has been pushed back after storm events closer to Australia?
Generally, Philippines, Solomon Islands, Fiji are among those countries that face significant storms, but our effect is more like an average effect across all islands. I'm not sure if we can really isolate one particular country facing this in isolation. It is the storm-prone island countries overall around the globe that has this effect.
Yeah, and I know you looked at other countries that weren't as storm-prone and you didn't find it there. What are the implications for a country like Australia, which is an aid donor, which is acknowledging that it has a relationship in our geopolitical neighbourhood?
General developmental assistance has some strings attached to it, such as keeping democracy levels high, maintaining political rights and civil liberties. But in the case of disasters, there are no such strings attached. The donor countries provide assistance out of goodwill and for humanitarian purposes. And that becomes sort of the issue in a way where any aid without any strings attached may end up being used for citizens' detriment.
So disaster aid can lead to this creeping militarism and autocracy, but general developmental aid, developmental assistance, that, as you say, normally comes with strings and it's attached to programs and there are outcomes. So that would be a more positive force.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what our results show.
That is really interesting. Thank you, Mehmet, for joining us today again on The Money.
Thank you, Richard.
Professor Mehmet Ulubasoglu from Deakin Business School. That's it for now. The Money is produced by Kate McDonald. I'm Richard Adie.
All right, what's your religion?
Catholic.
Baptist.
I'm an atheist.
Do you have a favourite child?
Yes, I do.
What's the grossest medical procedure you've ever had done?
Birth, that's pretty gross.
All natural, always stitches afterwards.
How much do you earn?
I don't know.
Me?
Can't tell you.
No, I'm not comfortable answering that.
Money. We are so weird about it. People will literally tell you their most intimate secrets before they tell you how much they make. I'm Claire Hooper. I'm a comedian and I have a button in my purse. I'm bad with money and I'm not the only one. I'm on a mission. You and I are going to turn that around. We're going to get good with money. So, have you never, ever looked at your super? Do you let your partner deal with finances because it seems too hard and boring and annoying? Do you look at your savings and say, hey, where did they go? This is why we are here. I'm going to track down the best experts in the country to give us the skills we somehow missed.
It's one of those things, it's bigger in your head. So when you start doing it, you're like, why have I put off this doing this for so long? It's, oh, wow. Okay, all right. Yeah, I've got this.
The Pineapple Project, the podcast that makes you better at money. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. It's free. Duh. It'll be the best money you'll never spend.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.